I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 4:18 on Thursday, May 15th, and we're here in room 120. Please mute your cell phones today. Members present include Representatives McCabe, Representative Holland, Representative Moore, is she on Teams? Representative Vice Chair Story and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. And our record secretary today is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juneau LAO is Zach Lawhorn. Our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay. Thank you all again for helping us out today. We do have four items on today's agenda for House State Affairs, and we will try to get through those within the hour. If that's not possible, we will roll over to at maximum another hour in order to get through our agenda today. I'll note that Representative Himshue has just joined us. We'll start today with consideration of amendments and public testimony on House Bill 11, PFD contributions to the general fund from Representative Prox, then have consideration of amendments and public testimony on House Bill 1, the gold and silver specie bill from Representative McCabe. After that, we will do public testimony on House Bill 4, the presidential write-ins from Representative Sadler, and have our introductory hearing and public testimony on House Bill 133, on prompt payment of contracts from Representative Himshue. So the first item on today's agenda is House Bill 11, PFD contributions to the general fund from Representative Prox. At our hearing on Tuesday, we set this bill aside and set an amendment deadline for Wednesday, May 14th at 5 p.m. We did receive three amendments. Before going to amendments, we're going to take public testimony on House Bill 11. So at this time, I'll open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 11? Seeing none and seeing no one online, we're going to close public testimony on House Bill 11. And at this time, I'd like to invite the bill sponsor's staff, Riley Nye, to the table. Is there any additional discussion on House Bill 11? I will also note that we have PFD Division Director Genevieve Wachutzik available for questions as well. Seeing no additional discussion, we can move on to our amendment process. And the first amendment for this bill is from my office, so I'll go ahead and move Amendment 1 and then object so that I can explain it. Amendment number 1 simply changes the amount that someone can donate their PFD from an increment of 10% to increments of $25. That aligns with how we currently do Pick, Click, Give, that program, and the dollar increments also aligns with how individuals are currently able to donate to the education raffle or pay for a ticket in the education raffle. It's my belief that doing it this way will lead to less confusion for people who are applying for their dividend, who may not realize whether it's 10% of the dividend's total or 10% of the remainder once the donations to the general fund takes effect in that calculation. So that is why I'm offering amendment number 1. Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. What I typically do for every amendment is ask the bill sponsor, the bill sponsor's staff, on their thoughts about the amendment.
Through the chair to Representative Himshue, for the record, Riley Nye, staff to Representative Prox. Thank you for the question. I spoke with Representative Prox about this, and this would be a friendly amendment to him. It's not going to affect the implementation of the bill, and so thank you.
Thank you for that information.
Representative Holland.
Sorry. Thank you. A question to the bill sponsor, I believe, but perhaps others might help. With this $25 increment, and this is a nitpicky question, sorry, if somebody wants to basically give away the rest of their check after the raffle, Pick, Click, Give, and they've got something left, the $25 amount is unlikely to match the final actual amount of the PFD. Did you consider any way to allow this to essentially sweep the rest so we could avoid sending a check for $7? Because $25 wasn't an increment of the PFD amount. Any thoughts on that? I mean, not sure that that's a big issue, but it was just mentally processing, can we avoid that loose end if that was the intent that somebody had?
Yeah, so to Representative Holland, I did think about that scenario, and I know we had discussed it. I know just from anecdotally talking with other individuals besides just myself on how folks like to do pick, click, give, that if you want to give the entirety of your dividend, sometimes you'll just donate far more than you might expect the dividend to be in order that you wouldn't get any remainder. So, for example, most people do not expect their dividend check to be $5,000. So some people, I've personally encountered this, will give, say, a $2,000 donation at the end of their dividend to the charity of their choice. And that's essentially their way of saying, I don't want to receive a dividend. I imagine one could do the same for this new addition program. They could say, put in $2,000 or more of donation to the general fund, and in all likelihood, they would not receive a check in that scenario.
That would work. Thank you.
Any additional discussion on amendment number one? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection to amendment number one. Is there an additional objection? Seeing none, amendment number one, also known as A.1, is adopted. And that brings us to amendment number two, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, Chair. I move amendment number two.
And I'll just object for discussion.
Thank you. If I can speak to it. Thank you. Amendment number two is simply a disclosure that would be added into the dividend process. It's found at the bottom of page two of the amendment itself. And it's simply providing a disclosure that the total amount of the dividend may still be subject to federal income tax, regardless of any donations that are being made or any of these new contributions that are being made, so that it's clear that somebody may choose to turn this money over to the state. And I think there was a consideration that we didn't want folks to be surprised later to find out that the entire distribution amount of the PFD was still going to be taxable income, even if you chose to put it to the raffle, something to pick, click, give, and then you put some amount or maybe all of it back to the state. It's still being deemed from an IRS standpoint as money you've received and that you have taken a discretionary decision on where it goes. So we thought it'd be helpful to disclose this. And I don't mean this to be scaring people, but on the other hand, I know with the energy rebate that we had in the last set of checks, some of you may have run into people who are confused about how much of that last check was actually taxable income. So this would address that situation I saw before, but also this new added layer that would be in there. Thank you.
Vice Chair Story?
Yes, through the chair to the bill sponsor, Mr. Nye's staff, our Rep. Prox's staff, Mr. Nye. Did the bill sponsor have any comments on this?
Through the chair to Representative Story. I spoke to Representative Prox about this, and we'd be happy to defer to the will of the committee on this one. I don't think this would cause any fiscal money as far as one-time implementation costs. I don't know if Director Wojcik would have any comment on that. But I'd just be happy to defer to the will of the committee.
So I think the question for Ms. Wojcik is, do you anticipate amendment number two causing an additional cost for administering the dividend program?
For the record, this is Genevieve Wojcik, Director of the PFD Division. Can you hear me okay?
We can. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Chair. So this amendment, adding that statement to the application, I don't believe that would increase the cost. There's already an indeterminate fiscal note for the programming of this bill. The only thing I would caution on is that the PFD division does not do any administration with tax, so we always defer to the tax division or the IRS for any tax advice. So having a statement like this on here would be a new piece on the PFD application or system or website. So I just wanted to note that for the committee as information.
Sure. Vice Chair Story?
Sure. through the chair, it seems, I think it would be helpful for the public to be reminded that there are federal deductions on your PFD, federal taxes to pay. So I am in favor of adding this.
Great. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you for the discussion we've had. And I just would point out that the amendment is worded to guide somebody with this word may, and here the dividend may be subject to federal. So I do respect the way the PFD applications and the website is pretty clear about not trying to provide tax advice. And this was worded in a way to not try and go around that, but on the other hand provide some notification that there may be a tax implication there. So it's trying to thread the middle between the approach that's been taken by the division so far. Thank you.
And I think I had objected for discussion. I'm not seeing additional discussion, so I'm going to remove my objection. Is there any additional objection to amendment number 2? Seeing none, amendment number 2, also known as A.2, has been adopted. And that brings us to amendment number 3. Representative Holland.
Thank you. I move amendment number 3.
I will object. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you to the chair. Amendment number 3 is a follow-on to discussion that we had at the prior hearing, where we discussed the option of could somebody simply not take their PFD and let it roll back and stay with the state general fund, essentially giving all of it to the state. But with the idea that we ran into two potential issues with that idea, one being that right now, if somebody chooses not to take their PFD distribution, their amount of money just simply goes into the pool that increases everybody else's dividend by a small incremental amount. So it doesn't really go back to the general fund. And the way the application process is currently set up, if they were to somehow designate it to go to the general fund, right now it would still be a personal decision to designate their money. So from an IRS standpoint, it's still money that you received, and then you gave it to somebody, so it's still taxable income. So it didn't really accomplish that. Staff, Mr. Riley from Representative Prox's office, had indicated during our discussion that he had done quite a bit of work trying to figure out what's going on here and how might there be a way to avoid that. And it suggested the idea, and we took the work he had done and took it to Ledge Legal and said, is there a way to construct this in a way that we could avoid the unintended situation where somebody, by letting the state keep it, could do that in a way that they wouldn't have a taxable event? And that the state could take it into general fund. So what this amendment does, in essence, is splits up the process of filling out the paperwork, establishing that you're eligible for a PFD, and separately applying to receive it, such that by establishing that you're eligible, it's carving that money out. But by not filling out the application, you're not actually receiving it. So it's not your money. And then it allows the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation to then sweep up all of the money that may have been eligible but not received by anybody. It seems to be a somewhat plausible pathway to accomplish the idea of somebody essentially giving their PFD back to the state so it can go to the general fund, but doing it in a way that they've not received the money and have to pay federal taxes on it. So I wanted to present this to you for discussion. I will acknowledge, and I think I'd like to hear from staff and perhaps the division also, I don't think this is necessarily easy to implement. I think the process electronically and potentially in the paper applications may suddenly be too much of a burden. But I also wanted to at least explore, and I really appreciate the fact that staff had done some work to figure out, could this be done? What would it look like? So that we at least have this option available, if not now, but in the future, to have thought through this process. So at this point, that's the amendment. If staff or the division can comment a little further, we might decide if this is something we want to move any further ahead with.
So sure. And before we do that, I just wanted to note that I made note that Representative Moore had joined us at the beginning. She has joined us on Teams now. We've also been joined by Representative Vance. Let's maybe ask the division first to comment on amendment number three, either practicality, cost to administer, et cetera. If you wouldn't mind offering your comments, Ms. Watusik. I'm trying to say it right.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Genevieve Watusik. Thank you for the question, and thank you for bringing this amendment forward. The division has only begun to look at the amendment since it was just produced today to us, and so we do still have some review to go through. The current bill has an indeterminate fiscal note for programming costs. This amendment, as it looks to for the division, it looks like it would need an additional fiscal note for staffing because this is now breaking the process, or as Representative Holland said, splitting the process up into two different pieces of applying and then eligibility piece. And so this would need additional manpower to accomplish this task as we read it currently, but we would definitely need more time before being able to give a thorough evaluation for the fiscal note.
And I don't know if Representative Prox's staff, Mr. Nye, if you have a comment on amendment number three.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair to Representative Holland. I did look extensively into this, and while I did find that the method may technically work, it's not exactly the solution that Representative Prox was looking for, as far as this would provide Alaskans with a sort of all-or-nothing approach to donating their PFD to the general fund or permanent fund. And we had hoped to find a solution to the federal income tax that would allow for donations in increments. But from what I found, such a solution doesn't seem to exist. And ultimately, he decided to veer away from this path.
Representative Hemshoot?
I just am trying to understand why an Alaskan would bother to establish eligibility if they're not wanting to receive the dividend. Like, it's just an extra step that I don't think many folks would want to take if they're, you know, if they're just out of their own goodwill wanting to support the state with their dividend. That extra step to show that they're eligible. Yeah, who would do that? I guess through the chair. Sorry. Thank you.
Additional discussion or comment, Representative Holland?
Oh, thank you. I guess to the question about who would do it, I don't know if there are many people that would want to follow through on what I've heard from many people, which is, you know, don't give me the dividend. Just use it to pay for schools, pay for roads, pay for all the things that we're trying to do. So, you know, I've got a lot of folks that are simply saying, we think the dividend ought to be used to pay for things. So this would be a way for somebody to recognize that at least legally right now, the only way for that to happen is for them to establish eligibility. So then there's a legal way for this state to then get the money back. If they don't do that eligibility step, then it just means a bigger dividend for everybody else. So it would have to be somebody that was motivated to say, I want the state to use the permanent fund money to help pay for our state services. That being said, I think given the uncertainty of this, given that it's really not addressing what the sponsor of this was trying to do, and yet I want to just acknowledge and thank the representative and the staff for having looked into this issue, because I think it was a valuable exploration of what some of these issues are. I'd like to withdraw the amendment.
Okay. Amendment number three, also known as A.3, is withdrawn, and I just want to thank Representative Holland for bringing this concept forward. I think probably a lot of Alaskans are unaware that the dividend is subject to federal tax when you're making that application, and thus the donations would also be. So it's a worthwhile issue to take some time and look at. At this time, House Bill 11, as amended, is back before the committee. Are there any additional comments or discussion on House Bill 11? Seeing none, I turn to Vice Chair Story for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House Bill 11 as amended, also known as 34-LS0182/A, be removed from the House State Affairs Committee as amended, with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
And hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 11 is reported from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and get ready for House Bill 1 up next. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record, and the next item on our agenda is House Bill 1 on gold and silver specie from Representative McCabe. We have had two hearings on this bill, and we did receive two amendments today. Before we get to amendments, we do have public testimony noticed, and I'd like to open public testimony at this time. And turning to, maybe we'll start with online just to mix it up today. Online, it looks like first we have a couple of people listed for, one person listed for testimony who I'm not sure if they're there for testimony. Daniel Diaz in Florida, are you here for testimony today?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm here for a testimony, and if there's time, as an expert witness.
Well, I think given the late start to today's committee, we're going to do a three-minute limit on testimony, but if you're able to stay online for questions, that would also be great. So please begin with your three-minute testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives of the committee. My name is Daniel Diaz, Executive Director of Citizens for Sound Money. And our organization, our purpose is to promote the use of sound money and protect people's rights to do so. We have been active across the country, especially in Florida and Missouri, that recently passed gold and silver as legal tender. Helping legislators across the country answer questions and help draft legislation to bring back gold and silver as legal tender and money. So the reason we do this is because since 1971, the dollar has lost 98% of its purchasing power. And most people in America, a study came out last year in the summer, that 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck with not $1,000 to their name. And in my travels lobbying for this exact issue, I've run across people who are struggling. In Missouri, after meeting with the chief of staff of a senator that helped us get it through in the Senate, I ordered an Uber, and the Uber driver passed by. And I realized the Uber driver was quite old. And when I called her, she came back. I got in the car, and I realized she was well into retirement age. I said, "Ma'am, do you mind ask how old you are?" She said, "I'm 78 years old." I'm like, "Why are you driving Uber?" "Well, I'm a widow, and my husband's Social Security, my Social Security, and our retirement fund doesn't pay me enough to eat. I have to drive Uber to survive. The Uber pays for this brand-new Escalade, and if I don't drive, I don't eat." Same thing happened in New Hampshire at the hotel, saying that that manager is working three jobs. She said she was working three jobs because she can't survive. This is the story across America. Because of the loss of the purchasing power of the dollar, people are struggling to survive. And by bringing gold and silver back as legal tender and money, it gives people the option to save what I call the economic energy, and it's something that is not going to be inflated away, and their purchasing power isn't going to be stolen away. Gold and silver has historically stayed above inflation. It's a wealth preservation form of money, and by getting rid of the sales tax on gold and silver, by not doing that, you're penalizing people who choose to save their economic energy and something that preserves their wealth, preserves their purchasing power, so that they don't have to worry about trying to find something that's earning 3%, 4%, 5% just to keep up with inflation. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to commend Representative McCabe for pushing this bill. He's done an amazing job. And I also want to commend all the other people who have been testifying and supporting this legislation, like Sound Money Defense, J.P. Cortez, Economic War Room with Ben Friedman, and Larry Hilton, which I think he's on the line as well. We all care about the citizens of Alaska and across the country, and this bill will help people, not just here, but in Missouri and every other state like Florida that has made gold and silver legal tender. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Diaz. And I see nobody else online to testify, so we'll go to in the room. I think we have Mr. Andreasen. Welcome to Nils Andreasen. If you'd like to put yourself on the record.
Yeah, thank you to the members of the committee. For the record, Nils Andreasen, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. I really want to come today. I appreciate the due diligence that this committee and the bill sponsor put into this bill, and I mostly have questions that that we're still wrestling with as we evaluate the impact of the bill. So I've got a few pages, and we'll see if I can do it in 3 minutes or not, but I also have a copy for the committee secretary. So first, our understanding of silver coins of the United States that are legal tender already includes nickels, dimes, and quarters. Does the committee have a more complete list of what would be considered under this bill? In fact, the Coinage Act of 1965 already states that these are legal tender for all public debts. How does this bill intersect with or build upon that federal legislation? This legislation says that persons are not required to accept gold and silver specie, but the state and local governments are not persons. Would they have to? Is the state prepared to? Do you have a fiscal note to support that? I would argue that local governments are not prepared to accept specie. And just to be clear, AS 0110-060 definitions says that A, in the laws of the state, unless the context otherwise requires, 8, person includes corporation, company, partnership, firm, association, organization, business, trust, or society, as well as a natural person. It does not include municipality, which is defined in AS 0110-060-A6, or state, which is defined in AS 0110-060-A13. Neither definition hints at either being persons, and it's very likely that both would be required to accept gold and silver specie as a result. Will the state hire an assayer to assist in the verification of the weight and purity of any special legal tender? Should local governments be prepared to do the same? Will the state maintain a list of approved assayers in Alaska? An assayer in other states has received a fiscal note of between $61,000 and $193,000. Is that the intent here? Will there be a state assayer? Which department would this be a function of? Will the state maintain a list of approved assayers and assessors? Are they currently licensed, or is there a licensing process? Should there be a board or commission established to oversee regulatory implementation and provide guidance? How many approved assayers currently exist in Alaska, and what is their just geographic dispensation? What would be the regulations necessary to determine price? Would the state use spot price, which changes daily? Is there an official spot price platform that you recommend? The state may choose spot price plus market premium. How should anyone accepting specie manage the variation or spread? Or does the state prefer specie at their par value? One example of this discussion, let's say the par value for gold is 42.22 cents per ounce. The spot price for gold on 2/2/2023 was $1,932, and the spot price for silver was 76 cents per gram. In addition, the market premium for gold is currently 2% to 3.75%. This proposal does not specify which rate the state should use when calculating a dollar value for the market premium. Therefore, on 2/2/2023, the state would have to accept an ounce of gold for between $1,070.64 to $2,004.45 per ounce. Because the spot price changes daily, it's possible that an agency could accept a certain dollar value of gold or silver one day for the payment of that debt and receive a different amount when those assets were converted to dollars, if they were. Will Department of Revenue promulgate rules for the methods of accepting gold and silver specie for debts owed to the state? Will DCRA do the same in support of local governments? How should local governments account for gold and silver specie? Would it be considered cash investments or assets? What are the best practices for implementing this within governmental accounting standards? It should be noted that Alaskans already use all minted U.S. minted coins as they are already considered legal tender. This includes commemorative coins. These coins are used as tender at their face value or would otherwise be considered collectibles.
Mr. Andreasen, I really appreciate the questions. Could you provide the list to the committee members?
I can.
Thank you. And if you could please wrap up your testimony.
I would note just the remaining questions have to do with foreign coins, with non-circulating legal tender, and the 10,000 or more coins listed in the standard catalog of world coins. We question how the legislation affects or intersects with Title 18 of the U.S. Code, Section 486, the uttering of coins of gold, silver, or other metal, what kind of counterfeiting oversight the state will ensure, and how you anticipate ensuring Alaskans are following through on their capital gains taxes. And it's worth noting, I think the previous speaker mentioned removing the sales tax, but there remains the capital gains tax at the federal level, and I don't know why we would encourage Alaskans to pay those taxes but not their local. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, if you could provide that list to the committee aide, we can get that distributed here, and we'll also put it on basis after the conclusion of the hearing. I do think we have one more invited or public testifier, sorry, online that I didn't see before, Larry Hilton in Utah.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak in favor of this bill. My name is Larry Hilton. I serve as general counsel for the United Precious Metals Association. We have in excess of 50,000 members throughout the country, many of whom are in Alaska and are strongly in favor of this bill. The association is dedicated to helping people essentially put themselves on their own gold standard using gold and silver coins as payment for goods and services as envisioned by the Gold and Silver Coin Acts of 1985, which were adopted at the federal level during the Reagan administration. At the last hearing, I noted that there was some discussion regarding consumer protection, and I just wanted to speak to that. This bill adds a very important level of consumer protection, as was alluded to by the prior person testifying. We've got the issue of capital gains tax on gold and silver. So if you're using gold and silver that is not legal tender, then under IRC code section 1001B, they're required to calculate what their capital gains. They have to look at what they spent to acquire the gold or silver used to buy their groceries, calculate the gain, and they're supposed to submit that. By making gold and silver legal tender, it becomes money, and then it's excluded from that very onerous, difficult calculation that would be imposed upon people when transacting in gold and silver. I'd also like to just point out that Alaska is the number two producer of refined gold in the U.S., just behind Nevada. So really, Alaska has in large measure a gold economy, and this bill would promote the use of gold and therefore promote, you know, Alaska's economy generally. There was also some suggestion that municipalities would be required to accept gold or silver for payment. The bill specifically says that no person shall be required. This is voluntary only, so I think it's important for the committee to understand that as well. There was also reference to a criminal statute, 18 U.S.C. 486, that imposes criminal liability on people that utter or pass a precious metal currency, with a very important qualifier, unless otherwise authorized by law. So this bill creates that safe harbor for within which Alaskans can operate without fear of federal prosecution under 486, as was raised previously. I'd also like to just mention, I referred to the Reagan administration, the adoption, or actually the remintage of gold and silver coin that occurred in 1985. There's a little known provision in there that requires the state or the Treasury, the Secretary of the Treasury, to take all proceeds from the sale of gold and apply those to the reduction of the national debt. And when asked, you know, how this was supposed to work, then Treasury Secretary Donald Regan explained to one of our board members some years ago that the concept was to give Americans the ability to essentially replace the current debt-based currency with a solid, sound money currency.
Mr.
And so
Hilton,
as people adopted gold and silver coins, they would retire the old system.
Mr. Hilton, could you just conclude your testimony?
Yeah, I think that kind of covers the high points that I was interested in making to the committee. The consumer protections, the protection from criminal liability, and Alaska's economy, and just the overwhelming number of people that are in favor of this bill. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you to Mr. Hilton. And at this time, I don't see any additional public testifiers in the room or online, so we will close public testimony on House Bill 1. And this brings the bill before us for the amendments process today. We will have final discussion on the legislation following our amendment process. So I will turn at this time to Representative Holland for the first amendment.
Great. Thank you, Chair. I move amendment number 1.
And I'll object for discussion, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. This amendment inserts this language, the value of the gold or silver contained within the specie, into the language. It was an effort on my part and in discussing with the bill sponsor to clarify whether or not the sales tax would be essentially on any sort of gold or silver that, from my standpoint, might meet the definition found on page 3 of legal tender and something made of gold or silver that could be a Roman coin from 2,000 years ago, in which case the sales tax, you know, might be exempted on the collectible value of it versus the intent, I think, of this bill, which was to exempt the use of specie as a form of value based upon the actual content and the value of the direct content of gold or silver in it. So this is an attempt to try and provide some clarification on what it is the sales tax is being exempted on. So this would, I think, conform to the intent, which is that if somebody's using, buying specie for the purposes of an exchange from a monetary use based upon the value, there would not be a sales tax on it. If it was a Roman coin made out of gold that was coinage from 2,000 years ago that had some value that was based upon its collectible value, that beyond the actual gold itself, the rest of that would be subject to the sales tax. So I don't know if this is perfect, but that was the intent to try and get there, and I certainly invite any feedback from the sponsor in terms of whether or not this got close to still protecting the intent of the bill or if it's got any unintended consequences. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. So, yeah, we've discussed this back and forth with the sound money folks and with Mr. Diaz, and this is not really necessary because if you're going to use a $10,000 Roman 1 ounce gold coin, it's a barter. Not you're not really using it for currency. That would be sort of beyond the realm of possible. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. People do weird things all the time. So they said it's not really necessary, but it doesn't really hurt. And basically what they said is if I need to leave it in there because I can't fend it off, then I should do that. But they also said to make you aware that the specie is going to have a certain premium at the merchant because the merchant may say, hey, look, you know, I looked it up this morning. I don't, you know, here's my set price for the day for specie. This is what I will accept. And there may be a little bit of a premium in there just depending on the hourly spot price. So I don't know how we get past that other than, as Mr. Hilton said, it's the intent to use it as legal tender that covers you under the code. So maybe you want to have Mr. Hilton weigh in on that or Mr. Diaz weigh in on the amendment. It really is covered in the bill, but like I say, if I need to if I need to let it in there to make it better for you or make it more acceptable, then that's what we'll have to do. So I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but I'm not really in favor of it either.
Okay. Additional discussion, Representative Himshute.
Thank you, through the chair. I've continually been troubled by when the government issues dollar bills, it's counterfeit if anyone else issues it. But with this, there can be multiple sources for it, right? So that's why I'm thinking maybe I do support this amendment as I'm thinking through it, because it's the value of the amount of gold or silver in the tender that is being traded, right? So I don't know. I'm still grappling with it.
Sure.
I'm going to look for new comments before we go back to Representative McCabe. Seeing none. Do you have one, Vice Chair Story?
Maybe I should answer that before we move on, unless you're in the same vein.
Sure. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. So, yes, you're exactly right. When the government who issues a bill that is not gold issues the bill and it's counterfeit, it's a crime. But remember, we're dealing with gold here. It has nothing to do with bills. Zero to do with bills, even though I showed you the specie, which it looks like a bill, but it's got gold in it. So we're dealing with using metals under our Constitution to as legal tender, which is so counterfeiting the gold, as I said, the consumer protections might be, I mean, we use a brown pen on $100 bills, right? That's our consumer protection. you might have to have consumer protection that includes, you know, looking at the bill, maybe a little jeweler's loop or whatever it is to find the serial number and all that. You might be able to look up the serial number on the goldbacks.com website. But point is conflating these with bills just because I showed you a specie or a goldback is not thinking about it in the correct terms.
Follow up. Thank you, through the chair. Right, I know you only showed me an example, and it was beautiful, but that example had a certain amount of gold in it that gave it its value. So if somebody has a different instrument and they claim there's a certain amount of gold in it, you don't really know that there is unless you have the equipment or the tools or the know-how or the whatever. So that's why I like the idea of saying that you have to value the gold or silver in there. I'm not sure that what I'm getting at really helps with counterfeiting so much as just ensuring that the consumer trading with this newly legal tender is protected because the amount that someone says is in there is actually in there.
It might be better to send this to Mr. Hilton, who's an attorney and could answer that, but so you can absolutely, through the chair, you can absolutely use a Looney, you can use a Krugerrand. They have to be stamped to be legal tender under our Constitution. They have to have the value of the gold, 9999 fine, and it has to have the ounces on it, 1 troy ounce, 2 troy ounce, whatever it is. Frankly, the goldbacks, in my opinion, are less counterfeitable than a Krugerrand or even one of our Eagles, just because of the counterfeit protections that they have in them. But I don't know how much time you want to spend, if you want to have Mr. Hilton weigh in or not, Chair Carrick.
Yeah, I think we can have Mr. Hilton weigh in briefly. We have a pretty packed agenda today, so I'd like to try to keep answers brief. But Mr. Hilton, do you have a comment here?
Yes, and I'll make it brief. Gold is generally valued based on 3 criteria: form, weight, and purity. So when you say based on the value of the gold or silver that's contained in the monetary unit, you have to understand what is the form, the purity, and the weight. So, for example, a 400-ounce bar that's used typically by central banks, that would have one value for the gold, whereas, so let's take the far end, a gold back, which is 1/1000th of an ounce, is going to have another value because of the utility factor, the premium that's associated with it. So the way that other states have dealt with this is they put a percentage on it. They said that the value of the gold or silver instrument is exempt from taxation, up to a certain percentage over the existing spot price, which is based on a 400-ounce bar, like 100% or something like that. Because something like collectible or jewelry, it's going to be many multiples times the actual value of the gold measured against a 400-ounce bar. So I think maybe if you say, not to exceed 100% of the spot or daily fix price. It's London Bullion Market Association, the LBMA, publishes a daily rate based on a 400-ounce good delivery bar. The UPMA, United Precious Metals Association, they publish a daily rate based on the U.S. minted gold coin. So, and those are different because there's different premiums. So that's what I would suggest is just say perhaps a percentage over the daily fixing rate, the most recent LBMA daily fix.
All right. We'll move on to Vice Chair Story, and then I had a question, I think, too, from Representative Vance.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. My question is not on the amendment, so I will ask it when we're done with the amendment. Thank you.
Representative Vance?
Mine was addressed already, spoken to.
Okay. Is there any additional discussion on Amendment Number 1? I think the original objection was mine for discussion. I'm going to remove my objection to Amendment Number 1. Is there any additional objection? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1, also known as A.1, has been adopted. And that brings us to Amendment Number 2, also known as A.2, and I will move Amendment Number 2 and object so that I can explain it. Amendment Number 2 simply adds to the last section of the legislation concerning a legislative budget and audit study on that we will also study consumer protections and consumer behavior related to sale and use of specie. I know that this type of tender is already being used in Alaska, but we don't really have a good sense of how frequently it's being used or where it's being used or for what types of sales and purchases it's being used. So my intent would be to kind of have the scope of the study include looking at that kind of information. And it may, in fact, help to generate more of a specie market in Alaska as we think about ways to make it easier or even expand options. But then additionally, I wanted to respond to Vice Chair Story's concerns related to consumer protections. And I, as we potentially embark on this new legal tender route, just want to have the scope of the study also include a summary of what types of consumer protection issues may have arisen and what is being done to sort of mitigate any issues that might be outstanding. So just add some language about what's in the scope of the study on this legislation. And I would turn to Representative McCabe for a comment.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Carrick. So, I'm good with this. I think they were going to do it anyways. I think that I would think that would be part of what Ledge Budget Audit would do in the normal course of things. I think it clarifies it for them and gives them our intent of what we want them to do moving forward with this. So, I'm fine with it.
Any additional discussion? Representative Vance?
Maybe while they're doing it, they could study the use of Bitcoin for our other taxes that we talked about.
Well, Representative Vance, when you bring forward that Bitcoin bill, I promise we will hear it. Well, seeing no further discussion, I will remove my objection. Is there any additional objection to Amendment Number 2? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment Number 2, also known as A.2, has been adopted. And that brings House Bill 1, the underlying bill, back before us. And
brief at ease.
Brief at ease. So House State Affairs is back on the record. House Bill 1, as amended, is before us. We do have a couple more questions for discussion. We'll start with some comments from Representative McCabe and then go to Vice Chair Story.
I'm happy to let Vice Chair Story do them, and then I'll just cover mine and wrap up.
Okay. Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, through the chair. That's probably a good idea in case you want to comment on any of my questions. And so I guess my first thing is the timeline of how this will work in the bill, because I was under the impression, and I'm sorry, I thought that the study was going to happen first. Numbers on page 3C, that Legislative Budget and Audit Committee would be studying this. But then as I really looked at it, it seems like something would be enacted, and then they're studying it. So I need a clarification on the timeline. And then also, I'm remembering the discussions when we've had this bill before that I had asked about how much revenue does this impact municipalities, and if you could, you had some data on that, that they cannot tax anymore, and what would that be in general? And then the other thing that was said that was interesting to me, and again, one of the invited testifiers has said that there may be a premium in there when they set the price for the day, and so it was just, is it common to have a premium, and what kind of is the typical premium that they charge when they deal in species? And then the other invited testifier had said that on some states they put a percentage, the value is exempt, which we've exempted some things up to a certain percentage. And so we can go back and listen to the testimony on that, but I was wondering if that isn't something we might want to be doing once we hear how much municipalities are affecting them, if we want to set a percentage. It's exempt to a certain percentage. So those were just my general curiosity comments as we listen to testimony today. So thank you.
Thanks. So through the chair, yeah, when we ran this bill the first time, AML came out and said it was going to be several $1 million in lost tax revenue to the state, and we tried to get the data from them and never got a response, so we went out for the data ourselves. We talked to a number of cities that had sales tax. Many of them said they could not parse it out, like Wasilla. Well, we can't really parse that. We don't know what the difference is if a store sells teddy bears and gold coins. They just pay us the tax. We never get that granular with it. So we basically estimated it based on some states that did have data of equal size, such as New Hampshire, and extrapolated it down to our population. And the end result was less than $27,000 statewide worth of possible lost tax revenue. And that was, we felt, going to be mitigated by the fact that in any kind of a downturn or a serious crisis with the dollar, people would now have money in their safe to continue to spend. So we figured that the churn was going to, and the money to be able to be spent was going to be of a bigger benefit than the possible loss of $27,000 over a state of 720 or 35,000 people. So that was our calculations. I'm happy to provide those. I think we have them in the office, and I can provide them to all of you. Finally, just to wrap up a little bit, nickels, dimes, and quarters are not silver. So don't make any mistake from the questions you heard. Nickels, dimes, and quarters are not made out of silver unless they're pre-1964. So that's sort of a smoke screen or red herring or something. I don't believe, and Ledge Legal drafted this, I think they're going to tell you that person means state. The state does not have to accept this, but we will absolutely get a legal tender. So if you consider that the state doesn't have to accept this, then there's no assaying required. The state would not have to have an assayer or all the fiscal notes and everything else that was said. The state is not going to have a repository unless we decide to have a gold repository under a separate bill. All of this does, this little bill, all it does is allow specie to be used as legal tender, which is allowed under our Constitution. And you heard the lawyer say, talk about, the IRS code and the tax code and everything else. In any case, it's not the state to enforce the federal tax code regulations. I'm not even really sure why that's entered the conversation, but if there would happen to be some sort of an IRS tax liability, that's between the person in the IRS, not the state. It's I can't imagine what it would cost us to get involved with enforcing IRS regulations. So those are just some of the responses I had to Mr. Andreasen's comments, and I'm happy to set this aside and wait until Saturday if you want to answer questions now. It's up to you. I know that Representative Himshute wants to get going on hers. So.
I think given that we do have a couple more questions, I'd like to get that question related to a person under the status of this legislation answered. But I would like to see us get those questions answered and take action on this on Saturday. So please work with the relevant parties to answer those questions. And we will be sure to talk with legislative legal as well. So at this time, we will set House Bill 1 as amended aside. And we are going to move to House Bill 133 on payment of contracts next from Representative Himshute. And I'd like to invite her and her staff up for a brief introduction. And then we're going to go as quickly as possible, I think, into invited and public testimony, knowing we can continue to talk with the bill sponsor and staff as we move forward.
Thank you, Chair Carrick and committee, and I'd like to acknowledge my colleague, Representative Sadler, I think, who was supposed to be next in order, but we had a number of testifiers drop off because they've been waiting longer than 2 hours, so thank you for the flexibility. The bill I'm asking the committee to consider today is House Bill 133. Oh, I'm Rebecca Himshute, sorry, House District 2. Apologies, I jump in all the time. Issue we're looking to remedy with this bill is the sometimes poor performance in our ability as a state to make good on our commitments to our nonprofit, municipal, and tribal partners. And so the issue that we're talking about, I want to be really clear, is not a new issue. This is something the state has struggled with for a very, very long time. It is not any one particular administration that has had a hard time meeting our obligations. So as you're all very well aware, we rely as a state very much on our partners in the nonprofit, tribal, and municipal sector to deliver essential services to residents. And I think we're very happy when we can work with those partners and provide the funding they need to carry out the services that we as a state are unable or unwilling or choose not to provide. So those payment delays that I'm talking about, there is a standard of 30 days that we're supposed to meet when we provide grant funding to our partners. And when we miss the 30-day window, it can have an outsized impact on some very small budgets. If you can imagine a small municipality or a nonprofit or even some of our tribes are quite small. So it can cause disruptions in services to people who are normally being served, or it can cause our partners to reach into very limited reserves or take out costly lines of credit to cover expenses while they wait for us to produce the funds that we've committed to. It puts a financial strain, especially on municipalities, to sometimes to fund their payroll or their infrastructure projects that are ongoing. A lot of our municipalities are rural or remote. If you mobilize to complete a project and then your funding flow doesn't begin on time, to demobilize and remobilize is a huge additional expense. Sometimes our failure to make timely payments increases the overall costs of a particular project or a loss of investment returns. And finally, it's just sort of a question of fairness. We want with this bill to establish parity with the private contractors that we do business with. So we want to make sure that we're a good partner, not just to the private sector, but also to the municipal, tribal, and nonprofit partners we work with. So House Bill 133 establishes a prompt payment requirement for the state of Alaska to be sure that our nonprofits, municipalities, and tribal organizations receive interest payments if we're late, which is aligned with what we do with private sector contracts. So we're just trying to improve our own accountability as a state. And my staff, Ella Lubin, is here. She can help with the sectional analysis if you'd like, or we're happy to take questions. And thanks for your time.
Let's save the sectional and questions for after our invited testifiers and public testifiers, because we have had some folks waiting. So I'll have you guys play a game of hot potato here. Sure. Hop out of the chair and then come back in a few minutes. We'll start with our invited testifiers, who will each have approximately 5 minutes to testify, and then our public testifiers will have approximately 3 minutes to testify. I really appreciate everybody's patience today. We're going to start with invited testimony, and we'll begin with Nils Andreasen from Alaska Municipal League. Welcome back to the hot seat.
I guess thank you for having me back. For the record, this is Nils Andreasen. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony in support of this legislation that does make huge strides toward evening the playing field and making sure that local governments, tribes, nonprofits are paid at for the services that they provide on time. So I imagine that there are lots of types of payments that local governments, nonprofits, tribes depend on, but I want to focus for now on community assistance, which I know best and which are a primary issue for local governments. These payments have been consistently over the years been available as early as July. One member's history, for instance, who submitted reports promptly, since 2014, it was August, July, August, September, August, August, July, August, August, and then in 2023 it hit October. This last year it was November. We understand that DCRA requirements include the last adopted budget, the audited financial statements, annual assessor report affect the timing of payments for some municipalities. But in general, if you have those things in, the idea of prompt payment is that this occurs early enough in the fiscal year to make a difference. Keep in mind, community assistance applications are submitted in June. In fact, DCRA just switched to a new system a couple weeks out that we're looking forward to learning more about and making sure local governments can access easily. We're eager to work through issues that are seen as barriers to distribution. We'd like this committee and administration officials to explore further with us. For example, adding staff is one thing, but are there other actions that would reduce the time that state is authorized to distribute funds for these and other intergovernmental transfers and when they are received? What can we do to strengthen the information flow between agencies, if that's part of it, so that they each have what they need to review documentation and process payments? Increasing capacity is one answer, but removing barriers or reducing complexity is another. So we have to think about how much of this process is established in law, what's been added in regulation, where have we made it more complicated than it needed to be? I don't know, and there are likely reasons for all of it. And let me be clear, I'm not suggesting that we reduce the safeguards that ensure the state does its own due diligence and safeguards public funds. But on the other side of that, are local governments trying to do the same? Are there ways to streamline processes on both sides to help increase timeliness? The effect of late payments can be truly challenging for local governments. We've increasingly been getting calls into September and October, November, asking about payments, asking how they're going to make payroll, how they're going to pay workers' comp and property insurance on time. And at that point, halfway almost through the fiscal year, that delay, if that delay is too long, they've often been canceled for non-payment. The most stressful calls are when late payments affect payroll, with communities having to choose between keeping the lights on and paying staff. We imagine how this affects the provision of services to residents. I can tell you that it's extremely difficult to plow roads, fix potholes, manage a sewage lagoon, or run utilities when some of the base funding isn't available. It's easy to understand, I think, that delayed payments have a knock-on effect for everything else you're trying to accomplish as a local government or nonprofit or business. Cash management becomes crucial. Maintenance and other things get put off. You have to draw on lines of credit, potentially, or use reserves that were meant for a rainy day. Staff reductions might occur. All of it limits the benefits that you're able to deliver to your customers and taxpayers. I want to address the testimony that's been presented elsewhere by state agencies, including the inclusion of fiscal notes as part of this legislation. I have no doubt that Alaska's public servants are doing the best they can with what they've got. Fiscal notes are symptoms of a system that doesn't have the capacity to meet current obligations, let alone do more. Fiscal notes suggest that the way we've approached the state's budget has been self-limiting and understandably fiscally constrained due to revenue shortfalls. maybe they aren't quite a cry for help, but they certainly are good indicators that for the state of Alaska to provide some level of service, at the very least consistent across all types of contractors or grantees, there's a necessary cost. I agree with the representative from Big Lake, who recently described fiscal notes as a cornerstone of honest government and foundational to the legislative process. They're critical decision support tools that aren't something to be avoided or reduced, but to use to inform decision making. It's important to know that strengthening the state will take additional resources. That's not something to run away from, but to plan with. AML has also argued that fiscal notes should not occur not just when they cost the state something, but its political subdivisions as well. I've seen this in other states where they take into account examples of what it would cost a city or a school district to implement. In this scenario, where we're considering more than just the cost to the state, the cost to local governments, nonprofits, schools, and contractors would far outweigh, I believe, the additional staff necessary to make them whole more quickly. Committee members, HB 133 is just good government. It's asking of you to put in law the prompt payment of invoices and reimbursement requests for services lawfully and dutifully provided, with the expectation that the state, as a reliable partner, will have the capacity to do so. AML encourages your support.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Next, it looks like for invited testimony, we have Lori Wolf with the 4-Acre Group. Ms. Wolf, if you'd like to put yourself on the record and begin your testimony of approximately 5 minutes or less.
Thank you, Committee Chair Carrick and Vice Chair Story and committee members. For the record, my name is Lori Wolf. I am the President and CEO of the 4-Acre Group. Thank you for inviting me to testify on House Bill 133, which establishes prompt payment parity for Alaska nonprofits, municipalities, and tribal organizations for grants, contracts, and reimbursements from the state of Alaska, including federal pass-through funding. We appreciate the attention for Representative Hinshut and this committee and the state companion sponsor, Senator Kawasaki, and the bill's co-sponsors. This is one of the most important pieces of legislation for Alaska's nonprofits since the passage of Pick-Quit-Give program almost 16 years ago. Here's what Alaska organizations are facing right now and why this legislation is critical. 3, 6, 9 months, more than a year in delayed payments. A couple of $100,000 to more than $1 million in delayed payments. Delayed payments come from almost every department in the state and impact all types of services, from seniors to child care to domestic violence to housing, food security, transportation, public safety, and more. The state relies on nonprofit organizations to deliver services. We are the state's partner in conducting the work of the state through grants, contracts, and reimbursements. Yet this partnership, when it comes to cash flow, is broken. Because of the current process, nonprofits are routinely asked to report on money they have not received in order to stand in line for the next payment, which will also be delayed. This should sound odd and unbelievable, and yet it's real for hundreds of Alaska nonprofit organizations far too often. Some of our executives don't even know a reality that could look different because this has been the reality for so long. Sadly, delayed payments have become a normal and even acceptable practice for nonprofits that are providing essential services around the state. Importantly, this money has been approved by the legislature and signed into law. One would assume that if the money is budgeted, approved, and allocated, then spending could occur. This seems efficient. This seems like good government. In fact, prompt payment is exactly the rule the state must follow when conducting transactions with for-profit businesses, as directed by statute AS36.90.200. Unfortunately, these rules do not apply to nonprofits, municipalities, and tribal organizations, and they should. Over many years and multiple administrations, we have tried to solve this problem, hoping honestly that we wouldn't get to this stage. One former commissioner told us that nonprofits should just take out a line of credit to manage delayed payments, as though it was the job of the nonprofits to subsidize the state. Not only do lines of credit require collateral, which many nonprofits never have, it is not the job of nonprofits to subsidize the state, and that is exactly what many of them do every day. What other choice do they have? Our goal is to ensure that the state is efficient and that the work organizations provide for Alaskans is predictable, stable, and available. To demonstrate the severity of this issue, we surveyed Alaskan organizations to learn more about their experiences. Here's what they told us about their reality. The survey data you will have in a packet I'll send to you from us is simply a point-in-time survey to give you a snapshot of the pervasive nature of these issues. The top line impact of delayed payments include cash flow issues, operational delays, increased administrative burden, uncertainty and financial planning challenges, negative impact on staff and services, strained relationships, and impact on program continuity. Again, all of those are more detailed in a report that I will send your way after this evening. Our reality is that nonprofits do not have the financial reserve to float a major state grant or contract to support a program or project with their own funds while waiting for allocated state dollars to come through. And even if they do, as I have already pointed out, it is not the responsibility of nonprofits to subsidize the state's delayed payments. These impacts should be enough to compel us all to change how this process operates. But consider, too, that it's not just our entities and Alaskans who are hurt. The economies around the state are also harmed. Specifically, we know that delayed payment has a direct impact on the ability of Alaskans to access essential services. It has a direct impact on nonprofit staff recruitment and retention across Alaska. And it hurts the whole economy because nonprofits cannot pay their bills to other for-profit and nonprofit vendors. We need this legislation because unlike a business or contractor working on a public project, where current Alaska statute says they will be paid on time or receive penalties and interest, the rules also say the contractor can stop work until payment is received. Our reality is that we cannot stop doing what we're doing to get the state's attention. The consequences are too high for Alaskans who depend on us. I anticipate that one of your questions is, how much money are we talking about? Unfortunately, we have been trying to calculate this number for years. We have solid data from surveys and personal accounts, but there is no single system for tracking delayed payments that we know of. Each state department has their own system and process for tracking. I anticipate that you will also ask how we think this problem should be fixed. To be sure, we know that the state faces workforce shortages and technology issues, but we can't tell you how to fix those. Still, we will say that we can no longer remain silent while a broken system asks nonprofits, municipalities, and tribal organizations to carry the burden of both delivering services and covering the cost while we wait.
Ms. Wolf?
We want parity with for-profit businesses? Yes.
If you could just wrap up your testimony.
Yep. We'd like parity, and with our for-profit counterparts, and we would like for you to think to process this request favorably as it moves through committees. I will say, last but not least, that we understand that we do understand that there are now fiscal notes that are aligned to this bill, and we see that as an opportunity to have more conversations along the way. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Thank you for your leadership at the 4-Acre Group as well. Next, we'll go to Mayor Sam Shinar in Tuksuk Bay. Thank you very much for waiting and for joining us. Mayor Shinar, if you'd like to proceed with your testimony in 5 or fewer minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sam Chanong. I am from Tuksuk Bay and representing the city of Tuksuk Bay. The city of Tuksuk Bay plays a waiting game. Here's what happens first. We receive a letter from the state, our determined population for the fiscal year. We wait for another letter that will inform us of our estimated community assistance program payment. We enact an ordinance providing for the establishment and adoption of the budget for the upcoming fiscal year. We pass and approve a resolution certifying an annual certified financial statement of the revenues and expenditures of the previous fiscal year. We submit the CAP application certifying that we understood the requirements for receiving payment and agreeing to comply with all laws and regulations. Additionally, we wait to receive from our insurance provider a notice of insurance contribution with a July 31 payment deadline for renewal. We perform what is expected of us to qualify for and receive cap payment. Come July, the waiting game starts. Will we have our insurance coverage renewal for the fiscal year? We rely on a receipt of the cap payment for the insurance coverage renewal. If we cannot meet the July 31 deadline, we will be sent a 30-day notice of non-payment to either pay in full or initiate a payment plan before the end of August, which will have additional fees and interests. This was the process with AMLJIA. I was told we do not know if the same process will apply with the new insurance provider, APRA. But no matter, we risk losing our insurance coverage. One of our general powers listed in Alaska Statutes Title 29, subject to other provisions of the law, is the power to sue and be sued. We cannot afford to be sued or risk any area of the service that we provide for our elected officials, employees, and residents. We have limited funding. Our community no longer have the commercial fisheries that once thrived. We do not have the land resources to attract tourism in our areas, similar to those in the road system or Southeast Alaska. We cannot levy property taxes. The revenue sources that we depend on are local sales taxes, cap, payment in lieu of taxes, and some proceeds from charitable gaming. Having an insurance coverage is just as vital as much as for the state, the boroughs, and other municipalities throughout Alaska. The 2 years when we received our cap payments before July 31 were in 2020 and 2021. Last year, we received cap payment in October, which was 3 months after the insurance renewal deadline. I am in full support for the passage of House Bill 133. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mayor Shinar, both for waiting today and for testifying. Really appreciate your perspective. If our invited testifiers would like to stay on for potentially a round of questions, that would be great. Otherwise, thank you for joining us today. At this time, we are going to open public testimony just to make sure we do get that done today, and then we will take a little bit of question and answer on this legislation. We are also bringing this back up on Saturday, so if members have questions, we can also take them at that time. So this time we're going to open public testimony on House Bill 133. I will just note we did have one testifier who dropped offline and brief at ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. Sorry, we had a slight technical delay there. And at this time, public testimony is open. So if Ms. Susan Anderson, if you'd like to put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony in hopefully 3 or fewer minutes. Thank you very much.
Hello. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is Susan Anderson, CEO of Boys and Girls Clubs of South Central Alaska. And I say goodnight to all of our elected officials and their teams. We are in support of the HB 133 to ensure prompt payments for nonprofits, tribal, and municipal organizations. As a nonprofit organization committed to serving over 4,000 youth in 21 clubhouses across the state of Alaska, from Metlakatla to Nome and Sandpoint to Upiavik, a Boys and Girls Club serves kids in nearly every Alaska legislative district. Boys and Girls Clubs of South Central Alaska fully supports House Bill 133, which establishes the 30-day payment deadline for state contracts, grants, and reimbursements, agreements, and 21-day payment deadline for federal pass-through reimbursement. This legislation will provide reliability, transparency, and accountability for payment of state obligations. So our experience is that we were owed more than $1 million in January of 2024 from the state of Alaska, and it took 150 days to receive that. In January 2025, actually, it got better. It's been about 65 days to receive funds from the state of Alaska. And in these delays, as Lori Wolf was saying, it disrupts essential services to children, families, and caregivers. It forces us to take on debt or face fees related to delayed payments. It detrimentally impacts our ability to plan, and it causes extremely strained relationships with vendors and providers for crucial services. I will say there is one good thing. I will say that we just received actually a payment from the state that only took 10 days. So I don't know whether it's the hearings that are doing it, but I appreciate that. So we're a youth-facing grant-funded nonprofit with an annual budget of about $12 million, and we do not have the flexibility to float payments on behalf of the state. We can't really pause services, though, as mentioned, because we serve kids and families, and we have commitments to staff and vendors. But if these timely payments do not keep coming, we may have to adjust. And we do not have disposable or reserve funds. So we are very much in favor of HB 133 because it will strengthen Alaska's nonprofit sector, ensuring that the funds are dispersed in a timely manner so we can focus on delivering critical programs to the communities that need them most. And we urge the legislature to pass this bill and create a more sustainable and timely funding process for organizations that serve Alaskans, especially Alaskan children, every day. So, Ganeshish, thank you very much.
Thank you to Ms. Susan Anderson. Really appreciate you calling in to testify today. And last on the public testimony, I believe we have Trevor Storrs. Welcome, Mr. Storrs.
Good afternoon, and thank you. For the record, I'm Trevor Storrs, President and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust. We offer strong support for House Bill 133, which would ensure timely payment to the state of Alaska to all parties that provide essential support under the state agreement. As a statewide lead organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect, we support policies that strengthen Alaska's communities and families, and ensuring our partners are fully paid is one of those ways. House Bill 133 does this by ensuring both state and federal pass-through funds are promptly dispersed to nonprofits, local governments, and tribal organizations. Alaska nonprofits continue to experience systematic challenges with long delays in payments that have impacted Alaska's communities and the state economy. Timely payments from the state of Alaska are essential for nonprofits and our partners to execute state policy in an efficient manner, including state policy that protects and supports Alaska's children, youth, and families. According to Kids Count, in 2023, 37,000 families accessed public assistance, accounting for 21% of Alaska's families with children. Families who access public assistance likely also access services provided by nonprofits, municipalities, and tribal organizations that partnering with the state of Alaska. Delays in payment have affected services from child care to domestic violence services to housing, food security, public safety, and more. Access to these types of services plays an essential role in preventing child abuse and neglect and ensuring our children and families thrive. House Bill 133 would support the work of Alaska's nonprofits, local governments, and tribal organizations to provide resources for Alaska's families. Timely payment to support their work of these entities is important for strengthening Alaska's families and communities. We encourage your support for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Storrs. I don't see anybody else online to do public testimony today. Just double checking. And I don't see anybody in the room to do public testimony. So at this time, we will close public testimony on House Bill 133. And the legislation is back before the committee. Are there questions from committee members on House Bill 133 today? Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, through the chair. My question, I'm not sure we have online if it's the Department of Commerce who's online about payments, but certainly there's compelling testimony about the need for timely payments. My questions, and we did see the report in the 4-acre group in the back, and I know there's a new updated fiscal note that I do not have in my packet, but I have a couple of questions. One is, it looks like you have estimated, and I don't know if it's looking through data for the 4-acre group, how many nonprofits, other entities that we are not paying on time, so we can get an idea of how we can, what staff it will take to get them on time, how the process can be changed. And again, I actually have a lot of questions, like what is the process to paying our payments right now? And I also have a question about, I do know private contractors are not paid on time either, even though currently they are supposed to be paid on time. And so I'm wondering, what is our fees that we, the interest we're, the fees we're having to pay to our private contractors? So I'd like to know about the process and, well, I said the questions, and I don't know if we want to have written responses back. I know the hour is getting late, but I would appreciate that information.
So I will let the bill sponsor weigh in, and I just wanted to note we do have a couple folks online for questions. Angela LaFlamme with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Eric DeMolin with the Department of Administration, and Hannah Lager with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I would ask that Ms. Lager potentially take those questions into consideration and try to provide some answers for us in writing before the next hearing. And then I'll also ask Representative Himshute to comment.
Okay, thank you, Chair Carrick, through the chair to the committee and to Vice Chair Story. We will also have departments online on Saturday to help with this. But in short, we've worked with many of the departments to try to nail down what the issues are, and it comes down to usually either staff turnover and therefore also lack of training or need for training, or it's computers and technology. So one example we found that I thought was compelling was that a couple of departments have been able to submit a zero fiscal note, meaning they're meeting their 30-day deadline. And I'm really grateful to all the departments for their input, because they've generally said, we're aware of the 30 days. We really want to meet the 30 days. And then they've worked with us to sort of explore some of the issues around not making the 30-day cutoff. And there were a couple of things offered that I think were useful. One department has an email for grants so that no matter who's staffing, who's hired, the email remains the same for all the grantees. So they have one place to turn, and then staff goes to that email to follow up, rather than having the email specific to a person who may or may not stay with the agency, stay with the department. Also, the use of uniform grant awarding software or granting software. There are states that have one form of grant software that every department uses. We have different grant software across all departments, so we likely lose some efficiencies there. So we're digging in and trying to understand. This is nothing about this bill is intended to accuse departments of of not doing their due diligence. I think it's legitimate that they're having a hard time making the 30 days. The problem remains the 30 days. When we don't make that 30-day deadline, it falls on the backs of organizations that aren't well-equipped to handle the delay. I don't know if that helps answer the question.
Follow-up, thank you. Through the chair, that does help to learn more about the process and what might be the impediments. It just makes me think about a couple of things, and one of them is, again, would be the timeline be to move it to 45 days? I don't know how much problem that is for contractors and for the, because we want to have parity, obviously we want to have, but is there a timeline that may work? Because I guess I just want to hear more about how much interest payments that we are making, what it's costing the state of Alaska, and what do we need to do. I don't want to put a timeline in the bill and say we're going to do it if it's unrealistic. I mean, what should the timeline be that's reasonable? Is it 30 days? Is it 45? Is we heard 10 earlier today. It's really timely. But anyway, it would just help me get a more of a grasp on the problem and what we can do to improve it. So thank you.
Through the chair, if I could respond to that, the some departments are making the 30 days. So to extend it to 45 would actually be taking a step backwards. I think our better goal is to help other departments make it within 30 days, find out what they need, and support them to get that.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, I appreciate this bill. You and I, we talked, and this bill basically says, hello, state of Alaska, do the job you're supposed to do, right? I mean, everybody else on the planet has a net 30 for contractors, right? Or if you go past 30, you pay interest on it. Why does the state of Alaska think they can get away with going a year owing a village or a NGO or a small Native corporation $1 million? That's almost unconscionable. That's really treating our small villages poorly. And I think we need to fix it. So one reason that I supported this, I have worked for a company that flew a pile of hours for the state of Alaska under the one of the previous administrations several years ago, 10, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they ever got paid. So and they might have just given up on it. So I know that there are people out there that won't even do business with the state of Alaska because of that reason. So I think this is something that we shouldn't need to fix, but that we do need to fix. And I agree with Mr. Andreasen. We have got to find a way to get our departments to stop weaponizing fiscal notes. So welcome to the conservative side of the house, because that's what they do to us all the time.
Could I respond?
Yeah, Representative Hemshire.
Thank you, through the chair. I wanted to just reiterate. I want to be really careful with this bill that we are not looking to place blame on anyone. And I don't think that we have underperformance with individual state workers. I think we have more of a systemic problem, and it's going to take. We're going to have to really examine it to find the solutions, but I'm pretty committed to working through the process and bringing relief to the partners, private and public.
I had put myself in the queue. I think we'll have two more questions, one from myself and then one from Representative Holland. I fully support the intent of House Bill 133. I think it's really important for us to do this. And the testimony we heard was very, very compelling. I am just curious what happens in other states, although I'm not looking for a state-by-state comparison, or I guess in other examples, when, say, a tribal organization is relying on that contract to pay their utility payments, or I can't remember the example the mayor of Tuxuk Bay used, but just a really compelling case about the penalties, late fees, interest, etc. Are there any provisions in statute for our private sector, or is there any sort of remediation in other circumstances for payment of those types of consequences as a result of late payments?
Thank you, Chair Carrick, to the committee. Rebecca Himshute for the record. So we do have in statute a prompt payment statute for private sector, which is 30 days, and it comes with a 10.5% interest penalty. We haven't been able to narrow down. We've had a request in with DOT for some time about whether they're have they made payments and how many payments, and you know, what is the actual cost of not making the 30 days. We haven't had a response from them. But prompt payment is trying to get to parity is a fairly new concept that's only been exercised in a few states. We would have to do more research to find out how other states, where is Alaska on the curve in terms of our ability to pay on time. I don't have that information.
And just as a quick follow-up, so that 10.5% interest, is that sort of meant to compensate for late charges, water shutoff notices, that sort of thing that the contractor or the nonprofit entity might incur?
To the chair, I'm not entirely certain where the 10.5 came from, but it is in statute, so it doesn't change. It's not movable. It's set. And I would imagine it has to do with making an entity whole for their additional costs.
Okay. Representative Holland, I think this will be our last question, and then I do want to get to our last bill today.
All right. Thank you, through the chair. I've got some other comments I'm going to save for later when we come back to the bill. But for the moment, I want to, ask if you have or if it can be gathered, but I realize we don't want to start new work. If we're going to see a fiscal note about the cost of late payments, I think that fiscal note should include a statement by the departments on how much money they're making from sitting on the money that's in the Chief Onzi accounts and whatnot. We don't pay attention to the fact that in many cases the state already has the money. And by paying it late, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, they're making money on the float. And so I don't think it's fair that we face a fiscal note that will be the result of a late payment, unless they also show how much money was being made from holding the corpus of all those funds between the time they received it and when it finally goes out. I think we'll find out that the state is still very much ahead of the game on this thing, and I think we need to acknowledge that, and I hope and would ask if the fiscal notes we have to face could include an acknowledgement of that float amount, even if it's indeterminate. I think it should be stated in some form to balance out the potentially indeterminate amount of the interest payments. The other question/comment that I'm wondering if could come back is that from my standpoint, working in nonprofits and working with the state, my biggest challenge is knowing when I'm going to get paid. Consistency of getting paid late is better than not knowing when and if I'm going to get paid. So if it was 30 days, if I knew it was always 30 days, I can manage the cash flow around that. If I knew I was going to get paid at 60 days, but I knew for sure that at 60 days the money was going to be in the bank, I can manage the cash flow. The problem, I think, but I'm looking for confirmation, just so that we heighten what's really important here, is the consistency of payment. So that organizations that are managing their cash flow, they have to make payroll for folks, they've got to pay other vendors. To the extent that you know you're going to get the money on a day, you can do the juggle, what you pay and what you don't. So I guess I'm asking two things. One is, can a fiscal note acknowledge the indeterminate nature, if not a specific amount, of the money being made from the float? And the second is there a way that we can improve and potentially even include in this bill, but I don't want to necessarily change it, an expectation that when somebody's going to get paid could be communicated so that they can plan for it? I think that would be a big improvement from my experience. So any comments or thoughts, any of those would be great. Otherwise, I save the rest of my thoughts for later.
Sure. Through the chair, Rebecca Himshute, I want to talk about the float first. And I think that's a reasonable request to ask what the state is making. But I wanted to also point out this is a two-way street, and there are accountability measures built into a lot of these grants for performance. So we wouldn't want to erode any of that from the side of our partners as well. But, yeah, I think asking for those fiscal notes to take into account the sums and what's being carried is a a reasonable thing to ask. And then I want to caution also through the chair on the idea that consistency matters is absolutely, I think that all the partners would love to just know. I would caution about anything suggesting moving from 30 to 60 days, because then 60 days becomes the floor and it's taking, you know, 70 days, whereas now it's 30 and taking 40 or whatever. So I don't think that was the intent of the comment. But, yeah, I think maybe, again, these systemic things that we're learning about, and we're seeing from our side some possible solutions to the situation. We could add to that a solution would be improved communication. And I don't know if that's something we do in statute or how that could be implemented. But the idea that being able to say, hey, we aren't going to make 30 days and we're going to tell you 14 days ahead that we're not going to make that, that communication could be helpful. And that may be happening. I don't know that it's not happening. I'm guessing it's not happening, but we can certainly check and see if we can get more feedback. And I wanted to make a final note as well. The document from Foraker was a snapshot in time document. So the one that's on basis and that I think would be in your packets was not, it was really just a check-in, I think, back in like October, November. And so whatever feedback they got in that snapshot. So it's not like a study. It isn't a third-party study going deep. So I just wanted to make sure that that was clarified.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hipshute, and thanks to the committee for the first of a couple of conversations on this legislation. We will be bringing House Bill 133 back before the committee on Saturday for additional discussion at our final hearing. Just for members' information, it is my plan to take this bill back up early in session next year after our second hearing on Saturday. And so I hope that you all can keep it top of mind so that we can just hit the ground running when we get going next session on this. Our final bill today is House Bill 4 on presidential write-ins from Representative Sadler. This is our second hearing on the bill. We did hear this bill early in session this year. Today we will have public testimony and any additional committee discussion. Before we get started, I'd like to invite Representative Sadler and his staff, Melody Wilterdink, to the stand. And if you have any opening comments and can give us a refresher, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the State Affairs Committee, I appreciate the chance to bring House Bill 4 before you again. Understand time being what it is, I'll try and be brief, just give you a reminder what this bill does. HB 4 simply allows Alaskans to cast write-in candidates for president or vice president, just as they can for any other office. Now, its current Division of Elections regulations that prohibit write-ins on state ballots for these two offices. By contrast, state ballots do provide write-in candidates listing on state and federal legislative seats, as they do for the state governor and lieutenant governor. Now, the prohibition about write-ins for president came from regulations written by the Division of Elections and not from statute. Madam Chair, I believe that Alaskans deserve the full freedom to vote for candidates who reflect their own views, even if those names are not pre-printed on the ballots. I appreciate the chance to present this again, hear public testimony, answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Let's go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 4. And I don't believe we have anyone online or in the room for public testimony. So seeing nobody for public testimony, I'm going to close public testimony. Is there any additional discussion at this time on House Bill 4 before we set it aside? Seeing none, I am setting an amendment deadline on this legislation of Friday, May 16th at 5 p.m. And please work with my office if you have any trouble meeting that deadline, as it is tomorrow at 5 p.m. At this time, we are setting House Bill 4 aside. Thank you to Representative Sadler for waiting for as long as you did. Truly appreciate it.
It was fascinating, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Truly appreciate it. That concludes our business today. Our next meeting is, our last meeting, actually, is on Saturday, May 17th at 1 p.m. here in Room 120. We may have to adjust for the floor schedule, but it is my intent that we will have a meeting on Saturday. The current agenda for that meeting is as follows. We will have consideration of any amendments on House Bill 4 on presidential write-ins from Representative Sadler, Continued discussion on House Bill 133, payment of contracts, from Representative Hemshute. Taking action and potentially additional conceptual amendments from House Bill 1, gold and silver specie, from Representative McCabe. And finally, an introductory hearing on House Bill 82, designating a state dinosaur, from Representative Stapp. With no further business before the State Affairs Committee, we're adjourned at 6:08 p.m.